This evening we're continuing to look at the Sixth Commandment, and I think the only thing that I just want to remind you of is what the commandment says in Exodus 20, verse 13, you shall not murder. Now, as you know, over the past several Lord's Day evenings, we've been considering what the commandment tells us, which of course is that we are to protect life, protect our own lives and the lives of others. It also requires that we don't do anything that would take away life unjustly. We have yet to see those situations that the Bible tells us about where life can be taken away justly, such as in capital punishment, or in self-defense, or in just war. And we'll look at those in the upcoming weeks. But what I'd like to do this evening is to take the principle of the preservation of life and apply it to different things that have to do with the medical profession. We all know that medicine and doctors deal daily, some daily, with issues of life and death. And generally, they try to save life. I mean, that's what doctors are supposed to do. Sometimes we know that in the process of trying to save life, life is actually lost. And sadly, and sinfully, sometimes doctors even try to take life. And we'll see some of those situations this evening. But what I want us to do this evening is look at some of the, I guess we would consider, not so hard issues, sort of the matter-of-fact issues that we're all pretty much convinced of, but as well as looking at some of the hard issues of how to apply the Sixth Commandment to the area of medicine. And I'd like for us to look at basically three areas. First of all, how does the Sixth Commandment apply to matters of reproduction? And before you get too alarmed by that, I'll try to speak in fairly generic, general terms and not make it too explicit. How does it apply, secondly, to medical treatments and that all too difficult question, when should we treat and when should we not treat a person who is ill? And lastly, what should we think about euthanasia and what we might call assisted suicide in the light of the Sixth Commandment? Well, first of all, let's consider the Sixth Commandment and reproduction. Now, I know that you adults and many of you, our youth here, understand some of these terms, but I think our young children will probably not understand most of them, and that's okay at this particular juncture of their lives. But what I'd like for us to do is consider three areas, that of fertility, contraception, and abortion. Now, first of all, let's think about fertility. Fertility is something, of course, that people look into when they're not able to have children of their own. And we know sometimes it consists of some types of drug therapy to allow conception. And other times it has to do with removal of those elements that are needed for conception and then brought together, as it were, artificially, what's called in vitro fertilization, and then artificially inseminated. What should we think about these particular things? I don't think we have to spend too much time on this. But some things to think about. And in some cases, there aren't any hard and fast answers to the problem because we don't know all the facts. But I do know in some cases where fertility is induced by drugs, it usually causes multiple conceptions. I think some of you are aware of that. And sometimes in those multiple conceptions, you have the loss of some of those children. I'm aware of one instance where a couple conceived through fertility drugs, and I think perhaps triplets were initially conceived. And then one of the children died early on and was reabsorbed into the body, and then it also became apparent that one of the other two surviving had some pretty serious medical difficulties. It wasn't going to allow it to survive long outside the womb. And of the three, one of them survives. Now, I don't know if that is always the case, but doing research, if that is the case, and if the possibility exists that in the multiple conceptions there's going to be the loss of life, that has to be taken into account. And also what has to be taken into account is God's sovereignty in the situation, whether or not it is His will that there be conception, and whether those avenues need to be sought after. In the next instance of what we call in vitro fertilization, where the elements are removed from the individuals brought together in a a petri dish, and then the conceived child that has the best chance of survival is artificially inseminated. What happens to the rest of those babies, as it were, that have been produced by this procedure? Well, generally, as I understand, they are disposed of. And in a case like that, I think you can see it's quite obvious that life is lost there as well. So I think this is one of those perhaps not so difficult to understand situations. That when you have procedures that end in the loss of life, we have to be very careful with those things. I don't know if there are any other types of procedures that would not allow for that, or that have perhaps greater safety measures with regard to protecting the child, but certainly no procedure should be used that would end in the destruction of any life, or that would unnecessarily endanger life. Now, there are some other things that come under this topic, I guess you'd say, of fertilization that should be dealt with under the seventh commandment, and so we'll deal with it when we get there. Now, let me just deal briefly with the second area of contraception. We know that there are different forms of contraception. One of them that has to do with blocking fertilization, and others that have to do with aborting conceived children. Now, the one thing I should mention at the outset here is that there is some debate among, I think, Christians in general with regard to contraception at all. Some believe that it's wrong under any circumstances, and others believe that it is allowable. As a matter of fact, there's a group up in Stillwater, Canada. I think you're familiar with Stillwater Revival books. And they like to quote the Puritans, they like to quote the Reformers, making some very strong statements against any forms of contraception. But you have to take into account that when they're speaking about the issue, their understanding of how these things take place is quite primitive. And they really don't know what it is that produces a child. In their mind, anything that that might prevent it in the usual course of things may amount to murder. And they may see it in that way. As a matter of fact, those of you who are familiar with the account of Onan in the Bible in Genesis 38, 8 through 9, I won't go through any great detail of that account, but he married his brother's widow and was to raise up a child to his brother's name. Remember when that happens, when a brother dies, according to the law, which was later in the Mosaic law, the brother is to marry the wife and then is to raise up seed to his brother. The firstborn child of that union would bear his brother's name. But Onan didn't want to give his brother a child. And so he took steps to prevent that. I think perhaps some of the Reformers looked at that as what he did as murder, when as a matter of fact, he's not accused or condemned, or his life is not taken because he was a murderer, but because he refused to raise up a seed to his brother. And that's an entirely different issue. You might say this is one of the earliest forms, at least the only biblical form we see, of contraception. Now, even if the Reformers understood how the birth or the fertilization process took place, they might still object to contraception in general on the basis that it's wrong to prevent conception, because children are a blessing from the Lord, and as such, that should not be prevented. I don't really want to go any further into that issue than just that, because we're really dealing with the sixth commandment here. All I want to say about it is that there is a controversy regarding that, and there are differences of opinion. Some believe that we're not required to have all the children that we could possibly have, and others believe that we should have all the children that we can possibly have. That's something that maybe we could look at a later time. But with regard, though, to the sixth commandment and contraception, obviously, those forms of contraception, granted that it is permissible by the Lord, that do not break the sixth commandment would be permissible. But those that take life would not be. So any abortive contraception is obviously wrong. And where there's any question on the matter, it's best to err on the side of caution and not do anything that would endanger life. Now, That's something that requires some research. I'm sure that many of you here are aware of that. Some are not quite so obvious. So before anything would be used, you certainly want to make sure you understand what's going on. Now, thirdly, abortion. I think this is one that's so plain it hardly needs to be mentioned, because abortion is the killing of a human life and the ripping out of the womb a life that otherwise would have progressed, Lord willing, become a human being. And from our perspective, I would say there's probably, in our mind, very little difference between abortion and just plain out murder. As one person, I tried to sort of illustrate it graphically. A woman came in to an abortionist with her child, a toddler in one hand or on one arm, and bearing a child several months into her pregnancy. And she said, "I'd like to have an abortion." And the doctor said, I don't know if this really happened or not, but you can see this would be a good illustration. The doctor said, "Why don't we just kill this one instead of that one?" And she said, well, I'd never do that. And he said, well, what's the difference? See, there really isn't any difference. They're both human life, and both are to be protected. Obviously, abortion is a gross violation of the Sixth Commandment. It is murder. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you... I think it's plain enough that that is the case, but some who have sought to find something a little bit more specific in the Scripture would point our attention to Exodus 21, verses 22 through 25, where it may not be absolutely clear at the outset, but I think you'll see that this tells us that God considers the child, even the unborn child, as human life that needs to be protected. This is what we read. It says, "And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage..." By the way, the term miscarriage there does not mean that the child dies in the miscarriage, but what the Hebrew word literally means is that as they're struggling and the woman gets struck, she goes into labor, and the child is born. If you look in the New King James Version, for instance, it's translated this: "She gives birth prematurely." In other words, the baby is born, but in this case, nothing happens to the child except that the child is born a little bit early. Notice, "She has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." That is what we strictly call justice. If you injure the child in any way, whatever the man has done to the child shall be done to him. That is what justice is all about. You do this and you get that. So the idea here is, if the child is born prematurely and the child then dies, the person who caused the miscarriage is to be put to death. God considers the child to be fully human, fully in his image, at least in the sense that fallen humanity is in his image. And therefore, anyone who would destroy that life must be destroyed. That's what capital punishment is all about. But it's enforced even in the case of a woman still bearing a child who is yet to be born. So obviously, abortion kills children in much the same way, except in that case, the intent is to kill the child. Now, the other thing, of course, is there are those drugs that they've developed now that cause miscarriages almost right away. I think they call it the morning after pill or something like that. That's equally murder. To kill a child at any stage is murder. Sometimes it's argued that it's not a human being yet, but you could apply the same argument to a child. You could say, because a child is not fully developed, those outside the womb, they're not fully human. But they are. At the moment of conception, once the ovum is fertilized, you have an entire human being, an underdeveloped one to be sure, one that hasn't had a chance to grow to its full potential. But everything is there that is necessary to build that person. And as a matter of fact, we believe from the Bible that the soul is there immediately as well. So that is a human being. And so that life, of course, must be protected. Now, the difficulties, even for Christians, usually come when, let's say, the question arises, are there any legitimate circumstances under which an abortion may be performed? And some of those circumstances are, for instance, if the child is conceived by rape or by incest, or in the case of where bearing the child will cause some sort of danger or threaten the mother's life, what do we think about situations like that? Well, I think we have to again look at the sixth commandment, don't we? You shall not murder. Killing the child because of who the parents are, is that a reason to take away life? No, still a human being. And that's not a legitimate reason to destroy life. With regard to whether or not the mother's life would be threatened, how many mothers do you know who would gladly give their lives in order to save their children? I mean, how many have sacrificed their lives in order for their children to live? And how many do you know, personally, we've met some people, who the mother had cancer, and she could have taken treatments that might have cured her cancer, but she was bearing a child, and to take chemo while you're expecting a child would kill the child, and the mother opts not to take the chemo so that she can bring the child into the world. In other words, threatening her own life so that her child can live. Now, whose life is more important? The mother's life or the baby's life? Should the baby's life be forfeited in order to save the mother's? Well, you know what Jesus tells us? That there is no greater love than one lays down his life for his friends. And if that's true of a friend, how much more true would that be of a child that is your child? Okay. When the mother's life is in danger, I think we still need to see that both lives are equally important. You don't forfeit the child's life in order necessarily to save the mother's life. Both need to be protected and preserved if possible. I think the real problem comes when the doctor says there's absolutely no hope that the mother will survive if the pregnancy continues. But you know, the doctors, though they may be able to give us an educated guess as to what would happen, they don't know with certainty what will happen. And those who have been told that have opted to allow the child to live and to continue through the pregnancy and have actually survived, both mother and child. And if they had listened to the doctor, they would have killed the child for no good reason. I mean, there is no good reason anyway, but even what they were hoping to do would not be accomplished. How many do you know who have been told that their children are going to be retarded or there's some kind of problem with them, only to say, you know, their life is in God's hands and He will do as He pleases, and then to bring the child to full term and find out there's nothing wrong with the child? Doctors don't know with certainty. And even if there is a defect with the child, who's the one who made the child that way? The Lord is. And we don't have the right to take away life simply because we think that that child shouldn't live because there's something wrong with it. As a matter of fact, John Frame said one time that, and I think it's probably true, if you ask people who have handicaps, if you know, and those at least that have their reasoning, if you ask them whether they'd rather be alive or dead, they'll tell you that they'd rather live than die. They're happy to be alive. And so who are we, or who is any doctor, or who is anybody, to make that decision for that child and say that child shouldn't live because he doesn't have all his limbs? That child shouldn't live because of some other defect? We don't have the right to say that. We don't have the right to make those choices. That is in God's hands. He gives life. He takes away life. It is our job to protect life, even if we don't think, for some reason, that life is as valuable as it needs to be in order to live. Now, hopefully we wouldn't think that, but I'm thinking in terms of those doctors who might think along those lines. There's no certainty in the medical field. We can't just simply abort life because we think another life might end because of it. Every attempt needs to be made to preserve life of both the mother and the child. Okay, well, let's move on into the second, little bit more difficult subject, which is how the Sixth Commandment applies to medical treatment. Now, I think we all are aware that medicine was originally developed, a gift from the Lord, in order to save life. in order to prolong life, in order to cure sickness and disease. As a matter of fact, medicine is defined as the science of the prevention or cure of disease. And the reason it exists is to try to help somebody who's sick to get better or to preserve somebody's life from dying. I mean, that's the job of the physician. That's part of the, what do you call it? Is it the Hippocratic Oath that the doctor takes? He is committed to the preservation of life. Now, obviously, there's nothing wrong with that, and that follows right along with the Sixth Commandment, which tells us we are to preserve life. If you become a doctor, then you're basically operating within the realm of the Sixth Commandment, to doing what the Lord has called you to do. But obviously, the saving of life and the procedures that are used to save life must not unnecessarily endanger life, and it must not also take life. And I'm thinking along these lines as you think of how broad medicine has become. And now I don't know the medical field, obviously, exhaustively, but only on a surface level. Sometimes, as I understand it, doctors have been using the materials, if you want to use that term, sort of a euphemism for tissue and so forth, from aborted children in order to save lives. I would say that that is more than highly questionable. You don't want someone to give their life in order to save another life, especially if that's done involuntarily. I mean, if you make that decision to do that, Jesus says that's a commendable thing. That's a great act of love. But to murder certain individuals in order to save other individuals, obviously, is not. Now, sometimes in medical treatment, the treatments only really don't save life as much as prolonging death. And I think that's something that we need to consider for a moment. As I was thinking about this, I remember that we dealt with this in a Christian ethics class in seminary, and had a doctor come in to help us sort of examine the field to see, you know, what should go on. He gave us some pretty helpful things to think about. But first of all, one of the things we ought to think about is that the prolonging of death is not always necessarily bad. It depends, I think, first of all, how long you can prolong it for, right? Sometimes life can be prolonged for several months or even years, in which case that would probably be advisable. Sometimes it can prolong the quality of life as well for several months or for several years. And I think in a case like that, it ought to be used. But sometimes it's only postponing the inevitable while putting the one who is sick through an extreme amount of suffering, perhaps for no good reason. Now, things may be different now with regard to chemotherapy, for instance. But several years ago, when my mother was in the hospital, and I can't remember exactly what it was for. It wasn't for cancer treatment, because she hasn't had cancer. But there was a gal in the room who had gone through chemotherapy, I think at a time when it was probably in its more primitive stages, and there was this tremendous nausea that was associated with it. The woman said that if she had to do it all over again, she would rather have died than go through that because of the suffering that she had to endure through that kind of treatment. This is just simply to say that there are several things that need to be considered when deciding what route to take, whether to treat or not to treat. Obviously, if the treatment is going to prolong your life, then certainly take the treatment. But if it's only going to prolong inevitable death and increase suffering, then perhaps you should consider not being treated. And again, the biggest problem comes here is just knowing really what the situation is, because you don't know in some cases. You just don't know, perhaps in most cases. It's hard to know what to do then. I mean, think about some of the things that happen in the medical field. Sometimes cases that seem absolutely hopeless, people actually survive. Miraculously, their health turns around. On the other hand, cases where it looks like the illness is very treatable, they end up dying. Sometimes, after the treatment has been given, it's been found that it's better. It would have been better if the treatment had never been given. Donna had a very close friend by the name of Cammie, who had ovarian cancer. And she underwent an experimental procedure that where they basically give you a very strong dose of chemotherapy for a very prolonged period of time. And because this kind of treatment would destroy all of her bone marrow, they had to take the bone marrow out of her system first and preserve some of it, put her through a solid week, I think it was, of chemo, in which she described it as basically being turned inside out. It just devastated her body physically. And then at the end of that period, they graft some of that bone marrow back in and allow it to grow so that her immune system can come back up and can produce the red blood cells and so forth that she needs. And then she can leave the hospital. It was experimental at the time. What happened was, when she went home, she found that when she would eat something, she would throw it up. And so that went on for a while. They went in to find out what the problem was, and they found that when they... first of all, they thought there was some blockage in her intestines. And when they opened her up to try to relieve the blockage, they found out that her entire small intestines had been fused together into a mass of scar tissue, and now they were completely of no use to her at all, which means that there was no place for the food to go out of her stomach. And because of that, stomach acid wouldn't drain, and it began burning a hole through her stomach and actually made its way to the outside. And in the whole process, the cancer that she had wasn't stopped anyway. So all this to say that the treatment made her last days miserable. Would have been better if she hadn't had any treatment at all. Sometimes, on the other hand, it is better to treat. There was a young lady, I think, who may have had the same kind of cancer, but she was only in her late teens when she had it. They treated her. She went into remission. And 5 years, I remember at Horizon South Bay, a church we were a part of years ago, that they had a party for her when she reached her five-year mark, because that's fairly significant in cancer treatment. If you make it 5 years without a reoccurrence, then it looks good for you as far as whether or not you're going to have a reoccurrence. And you know, there are some people who also recover from what seems to be terminal illness with no treatment at all. So how do you make a decision in a case like this? I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. There's really no easy answer, and ultimately everything is in the Lord's hands. So all you can do is pray for wisdom, try to get all the facts, and then make the best decision that you can and trust entirely on the Lord for the ultimate conclusion. I should mention that with regard to Cammie again, that because of the problem and the advancement of the cancer, that she was in a situation. Here's one where I think it was fairly clear what you needed to do. Because of the blockage and because of the progress of the cancer, she kept experiencing internal bleeding. And she had a tube that was in her stomach that would drain the fluids. And when they saw the blood coming out of the tube, then they would know they needed to go to the hospital to have that bleeding surgically stopped. Well, after several trips to the hospital and no prospect of any hope that she was going to survive, she and her husband finally decided that it was time just to go. It was time for her to go home to be with the Lord. So what they did was they decided that the next time the bleeding would begin, that she would just simply go to the hospital and die there. So that's what they did. It was on, a Lord's Day evening. They saw the blood coming out of the tube. They had already told all the family members and so forth what they were going to do. When they saw the blood, they said, well, I guess this is it. The Lord's calling me home. And took her into the hospital. She went into a coma late that night and died the next morning. But went to be with her Savior. Okay, so the Lord did deliver her. So there are cases when it's clear that you should not do any further treatment. Some people are so afraid of death that they're willing to do anything to avoid it. But as Christians, we ought not to fear death, because the Lord has taken the sting of death away from us if we're trusting in Him. Now, what do you do if you decide not to treat? And that's not a violation. If you know you're going to die, if there's nothing you can do to stop that, it's not a violation of the Sixth Commandment to refuse treatment. Because obviously there are things outside of your control. Everyone's going to die. Okay? So if you know that that's the case and you know the Lord is taking you home, well then, you can decide not to be treated. And when that point comes, obviously, I think some of the important things to consider are to make the one who is sick as comfortable as possible. Of course, use pain management. There's nothing wrong with that. and a clean, comfortable environment. Try to make them as comfortable as possible. Many people decide that they want to die at home. And that is because they want to be around family members and they want to be in their home environment when that time comes. And I think that that is good. And I think that that's something that we ought to do, if at all possible, to die at home among your loved ones. As a matter of fact, hospice makes that possible. And we need to be thankful that they're doing that kind of work. There was a time when spirituality was considerably higher than it is at the present time. And people seem to be living much more intensely for the Lord, that to be around a saint who was dying was actually a blessing. Remember, they were hoping, because it happened on numerous occasions, that when the saint was dying, just between that time that he was passing away from this world into the next, he might actually say things or see things or convey things that would be an encouragement to those around them. And so they didn't want their loved ones who were Christians to die away from them. They wanted them to die at home so that they could experience that blessing. You can read some of those accounts in some of the older books. And I believe those things are true. So I think that they ought to be at home and ought to be cared for, of course. As long as the person can eat, you should continue to feed them. When they can no longer eat, then maybe it's time to stop feeding them. You know, there are some cases, and it's very, very difficult, where a person is dying, let's say, and they're on pain management, and the pain management is so great that it makes them unconscious. But even when they're conscious, they don't want to eat. And so what do? Well, they put a tube down in their stomach, and they feed them. And then at some point, they decide to remove the tube. Maybe it's questionable whether the tube should be there in the first place. The person can't eat, doesn't want to eat. It's because their body is rejecting the food because it's getting ready to die. So that would be, again, prolonging their death rather than prolonging their life, prolonging their suffering. There's no value in that. However, we have to admit that there are some cases where perhaps life support might be advisable, even if the person can't survive without it. Think about the case of the non-Christian who's dying. If the person is still conscious but cannot live on their own, and maybe there's no hope or possibility of them living on their own, what if they should be put in, I'm not sure if it's still called the iron lung or not, but put on artificial respiration. I think they have respirators now, maybe not the iron lung. And should you prolong their life, we've got to remember that if an unbeliever dies, where do they go? Immediately to hell. And I think everything should be done to prevent that. But what if they're unconscious? Well, we're told by doctors that those who are unconscious, sometimes in comas, where it looks like there's possibly no hope they're going to come out, or even if there is hope they can come out, those people who come out of those comas often say when they come out of those comas that they were aware of what was going on around them. They could hear people talking. They could think, but they couldn't respond. And so in a case like that, if the person is still alive, it's possible to still communicate it. If they're still thinking about things, it's possible they might yet still trust in the Lord, if the Lord is willing. But obviously, once they're dead, that becomes impossible. So in the case of a non-Christian, perhaps life support would be something that would be considered. In the case of a Christian who is ready to go home to be with his Lord, and there's no hope that he's going to survive off of life support, again, why would you prolong their death? Why would you keep them in a world that is the closest thing that they're ever going to experience to hell and keep them out of heaven? Let them go to be with their Lord. You know, sometimes because we don't want to let them go because of our own selfishness, we want to hold on to them. We don't want them to die. But if they are believers, it's far better that they depart to be with the Lord, even as the Apostle Paul says. But again, in all these situations, there's no easy answer. We always have to pray and ask for guidance and take everything into account, doing everything we can to honor the Lord in obeying the sixth commandment to preserve life and not to end it unnecessarily. But on the other hand, we want to make sure that we don't try to prolong someone's death if the Lord is calling them home. So anyway, those are some of the difficult issues we have to deal with in the medical realm. The doctor who came in and spoke to our class said, he just basically summarized it in this way. If it's treatable, treat them. You know, if you can prolong their life, treat them. But if you're only prolonging their death, then don't. And that was the standard by which he lived. Now, the very last one I think we can talk about quite quickly, and that's euthanasia and assisted suicide. I think everybody's pretty familiar with what euthanasia is. That's where the doctor decides that you're suffering so much that you would probably rather not live, and so they give you perhaps an overdose of some kind of a drug that's going to end your life, and you die. They put you out of your misery, is another way of saying it. And then in those cases where the patient is still conscious, and he doesn't like his suffering, he doesn't like the prospect of what's ahead of him, doesn't want to go through the remaining stages of this degenerative disease or whatever it may be, they say, "Doctor, help me die. Give me something that will kill me." And you know, there have been some rather notorious cases that were in the news, but it as a matter of fact, I mean, there are forms of this that go on in the medical realm all the time. Well, what do we think about cases like that? Even though it is to relieve pain and suffering, you know, even though the person would say that it's better off in the end if they die, we might agree, yeah, I mean, if you're not going to live, maybe it would be better to die, that still doesn't give us the right to take away life. I mean, who has the right to take away life? Only God does. And whether it's by drugs or any other method, it's the same thing as if you pull the trigger and shoot somebody with a gun. You can't just take away their life. Now, again, I think you should do what you can to relieve their pain. Remember, we saw a couple of Lord's Days ago from Proverbs 31, some of the instruction that King Lemuel's mother gave to him. And one of the things she said was this: "Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more." You might say that's the most primitive form of pain management. You know, people often turn to drink and get drunk in order to escape their problems. And if you look at, thankfully we didn't have to experience this, but people whose limbs were shot and got gangrene during the Civil War had to have those limbs amputated. And what do? For those people, I think there was some morphine, but probably not enough to go around. And when there wasn't, they'd give them a good shot of some kind of strong liquor to maybe take the edge off the pain, and then they'd go at it. Well, pain management is certainly prescribed in Scripture. Even medicine, take a little wine for your frequent ailments and so forth. But the instruction here is not to kill the person who is perishing. Remember the case of the young man who found King Saul as he was dying. Saul says, "My life is lingering, please kill me." And so he kills him, and then he goes to David and says, "David, guess what? I killed your enemy. You should thank me for that." David didn't say, "You know, you did the right thing. You put Saul out of his misery. That's mercy killing. That's, you know, euthanasia, assisted suicide, actually." And commend him for it, but he said, "Your own mouth has testified against you that you have killed the Lord's anointed." Men, put this guy to death. And they killed him on the spot because he ended that life unrighteously. And the fact is, he probably didn't even do that. But because he said that he had, his own words testified against him. To take a life was a very serious issue. The Lord says that only he has the right to take away life. Now, these are, again, some difficult issues to think about, but I think the principle holds throughout all these examples and throughout any way that we might want to apply it. God alone has the right to take away life. Now, that is in cases that don't have to do with just taking away of life. I mean, he does give the right to take away life in certain circumstances. And we'll look at those things this next week. But if the person is not guilty of some crime that they should be put to death for, we wouldn't take away their life anyway because we're not the government. We haven't been given that authority by God. But we are to preserve life, sometimes even if that means that the person has to suffer. We can do what we can to relieve the pain, to relieve the suffering, to make them comfortable. But we don't have the right to end their lives. Only the Lord has that right. So again, the Lord reminds us that life is precious, and we need to do what we can to try to preserve it. Well, let's bow for a moment of prayer, and let's ask the Lord to help us just to have the wisdom we need to work through these kinds of issues. Because we're going to be faced with decisions like this someday if we haven't already. And we need to know how to face these things with biblical principles. So let's pray that the Lord will help us to understand this and give us the strength to be able to put it into practice when it needs to be.